and it states our activities and our declaration. Now, as students, we are all independently devoted to the cause of theosophy. And we're asked to I know we're not asked to do anything, to tell you the truth. We're an association of students who keep before them the ideas of I'm just all confused here.
Universal Brotherhood.
Yes, but maybe I should just read this. My mind is not present at this. The policy of the lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. Loyal to the great founders of the movement, and do not concern itself with differences of individual opinion. We are not an organization. There are no officers, no bylaws. And we come together in a effort of service to humanity by keeping these ideas before the public. And doing that, we have two weekly meetings on Wednesday evenings, where we are taking up the ocean of theosophy. And on Sundays, we have a special class on a particular idea for the month. And myths and allegories is the idea that we are entertaining this month. And this and Sunday will be hidden treasures in the Bible. And of course, we have the Friday night meeting periodic every third Friday of each month. And we're taking up again the ideas of myths and symbols and relationship to reincarnation. Tonight we are going to be looking at two myths and symbols, that of the phoenix and of the serpent. And we will
begin with the phoenix.
We will begin with the phoenix.
Well, actually, we really don't even need anything beyond that, because in researching this, I had always thought it was one singular story and wasn't quite certain to what country it belonged. But that is not true. It belongs universally. Every culture and civilization has the same myth, and it is the myth of rebirth, of immortality. The most classic and well-known expression of it is the Arabian one, and it is the one called the phoenix. The bird lives in Arabia, lives for 500 years, then builds a nest, which it then climbs into, sets fire to, and the bird and the nest are consumed. And from the ashes 3 days later, the phoenix is reborn. So it is the symbol of immortality and reincarnation. But if we turn to the Arabian description, now first we wanted to mention the earliest reference to the phoenix, this bird that literally burns itself to death and then is reborn. The oldest reference on record, Hesiod wrote about it in the 8th century BC. But a larger, more in-depth description was done by Herodotus in the 5th century BC. So it's well established that this is ancient. But the classic myth is the Arabian one. It was said to be as large as an eagle, with brilliant plumage, scarlet and gold, and a most melodious cry. So beautiful that it was said that even the sun god Apollo would stop just to hear it. Its lifespan, 500 years, living on dew. Just dewdrops, that's all. Killing nothing, not even anything it landed on, like the grass. It was harmless. At the end of its life, the nest that it builds is of aromatic branches and spices like myrrh and frankincense. And it is, of course, consumed in the flames. After 3 days, there is a rebirth. And this is true of all legends and symbols of that rebirth. In Egypt, it's called Bennu, B-E-N-U. In China, Feng Huang. In Japanese, Ho-U. And in Russia, the firebird. The Egyptian Bennu, you have seen it many times. It's always depicted as a heron, you know, tall, skinny legs, and then a large bird. It's seen in almost all the Egyptian hieroglyphics. It was associated with the sun and represented the sun of the soul god. No, the soul of the sun god. That would be the right way to say it. In China, named Feng Huang, there were images in China for well over 7,000 years. And it is described in a very strange way. It has the beak of a cock, the face of a swallow, the neck of a snake, the breast of a goose, the back of a tortoise, the hindquarters of a stag, and the tail of a fish. It's a symbol of high virtue and grace, of power and prosperity, and represents the union of the yin and the yang. And next we'll be hearing about the snake, but in China, a very common depiction of the phoenix shows it attacking the snake with its beak and its talons and its wings spread. Sorry.
Well, that's quite right.
The phoenix wins. In Japan, it's very strange. Since it is a singular bird, there's only one of its kind. It never mates. It gives birth to itself through this fire. But in the Japanese name, Ho-U, it says that the Ho is the male bird and the U is the female bird. Well, it has to be just one bird, so they must be talking about a hermaphrodite bird. We don't understand, and we can't find an explanation. It is thought to only appear at the birth of a new era and a virtuous ruler who is going to handle that new era. Then it returns to its celestial abode to await another new era. It's supposed to represent the sun, justice, fidelity, and obedience. The firebird, we're all familiar with Stravinsky's composition in Russia. The feathers of the phoenix are said to keep on glowing after they're removed from the bird. Well, we don't exactly understand how anyone gets close enough to remove a feather, but it is said that one feather can light an entire room. It glows. In Buddhism, it's called Garuda, the bird of life, and it's depicted with an eagle's face and a human body, representing the cycles and periodical time. In Hebrew, it's called Onek, from Phenok, Enoch, a symbol of a secret cycle. In the Turkish, it's called Kirkes. And there it is said to live for 1,000 years and then is consumed and reborn from itself. And then the Persian one, the one you can read the most about in the Secret Doctrine, it's very complicated. It's called Simurgh Ankh, A-N-K-E. It is said to be an intelligent, polyglot bird and was born with the last deluge. The popular or current expression of it we find in the Harry Potter story, where the phoenix actually does catch, burst on fire and return. So it's very much still in the popular mind, but it's far older than probably we've ever imagined.
Yes. And then we come to the serpent or the snake. All of us have a reaction to that in our innermost nature. It does something to us. When we meet a snake, we have all kinds of feelings, from fear to awe. And we're not quite sure of the mystery that lies behind this creature. We've heard so many things about it, one being divine wisdom, on the other hand being a sign of that which is evil and bad. So where do these feelings come from that we carry around with us? Well, the serpent is a very ancient symbol. And in one of the Avestas, or the early writings, when it talks about the universe coming into manifestation, the fiery mist streamed through the universe, and it was depicted as a snake, as a great serpent in the sky. And so the serpent has always meant or have a correlation with eternity and infinitude and, of course, regeneration and rejuvenation, as well as wisdom. Jehovah is stated esoterically, is also the serpent or dragon that tempted Eve. And the dragon is an old glyph for the astral light, the primordial principle, which is the wisdom of chaos. Now, Hermes, one of the most ancient of philosophers and learned men that we read about, called the serpent the most spiritual of all beings. Which, you're wondering, whoa, I mean, we are not quite sure of all our perceptions now that we have. Moses, who also was initiated in the wisdom of Hermes, followed suit in Genesis. The Gnostic serpent with the seven vowels over its head being the emblem of the seven hierarchies of the septenary or planetary creators. In Hinduism, the serpent, the Naga, Sesha and Hanata, are expressions of that which is the infinite. And, of course, the name of the infinite is Vishnu, whose first vehicle on the primordial waters is the serpent. The difference between good and bad serpent, the astral light of the Kabbalist, between the former, the embodiment of divine wisdom in the realm of the spiritual, and the latter, evil on the plane of matter. So we have the serpent here is really divine wisdom, but there is always an opposite on this plane. But it is the same. Jesus spoke of the serpent. Be ye wise as serpents. Now, the Spirit of God moving on chaos was symbolized by every nation in the shape of a fiery serpent breathing fire and light upon the primordial waters until it was incubated cosmic matter and made it assume the annular shape of a serpent with its tail in its mouth, which symbolized not only eternity and infinitude, but also the globular shape of all bodies formed within the universe from the fiery mist. The universe, as well as earth and man, cast off periodically, serpent-like, their old skin to assume new ones after a time of rest. We find in the Bible references of the seraphim or the fiery serpents of heaven. And Mount Meru, exalted mass of glory, the venerable haunt of gods and heavenly choristers, not to be reached by sinful men because guarded by serpents. The serpent being oviparous, symbol of wisdom, an emblem of the logoi, or the self-born. And it states that the serpent with the egg relates to cosmic creation. The tree and the serpent are also intertwined in an esoteric expression. The tree, of course, growing with its leaves on the material plane and its roots in heaven. But that serpent is wrapped within its leaves and within its branches. And that, and it's said that that fall into generation, or that fall was when those branches touched the mud of matter. So we have the dragon of good, the serpent of evil, represented on earth by the right and left hand magic. The tree is man himself, and the serpent dwelling in with the in each. I'm sorry, the tree is man himself, and the serpent dwelling within each is the conscious manus, the connecting link between spirit and matter, heaven and earth. Now, there's the serpent was always in reference to the wise ones. The serpents being run out of Ireland. Again, there's a reference to this, to the wise, the learned. And that the expression to eat of the heart of a dragon or eat of its liver is really esoterically means that this person who has done that has been imparted the divine wisdom, and they have eaten of a portion of it. And and forever the serpent, we find occult tales of the serpent that show the darkness that is equated with it. But we also, as referenced in the secret doctrine of the many pyramids that are found throughout the world, that under every one of them are a serpent's holes. And then if you go back and read further, it said that the initiates dug great tunnels under the earth, and there are preserved the records of eternity. And we all know from Alexandria when it burned that all those collections, many of them disappeared. And that we know in Tibet, in the Lhasa, the great monasteries, that there are tunnels underneath all of these monasteries. You go into the jungles of South America, there are tunnels under all of those pyramids. So the snake conjures up a great mystery in our mind. It is the divine aspect of our nature. Now, rather, we would, I guess, say prophetically, the Roman Catholic Church has taken that and degraded it even more. And the idea of the devil and so forth as being an entity, which is completely false. That the serpent from the beginning, as was said, was simply the light being imparted to man to eat of that fruit of knowledge and of wisdom. If you have any questions.
Yes.
There was a statement about the liver, eating the liver of the dragon. It's interesting, that kind of ties in with the piercing of the liver of Christ, the eating of the liver by the vultures of Prometheus. And there seems to be some sort of a esoteric tie-in with that. Did either one of you run across anything?
Well, it's the liver is supposed to represent physical, material life. It is the lower part of our nature. So I would imagine it's a question of combining the higher and the lower in one, so you have unity.
We also know that the organs are influenced by other planets, and there's a correlation. But think, who gave it the name liver?
Right.
What does that mean, liver? You know, it has, as was stated, something to do with life on this material plane. It is a mystery.
It's a chemical factory that
it is.
Changes everything that you take in into what the body needs, so you can live.
Yeah.
You had...
Two things came to mind in hearing about the serpent. The shedding of the skin, we were thinking the body rejuvenating every 7 years. The cells literally are changed out for new cells and so forth. There must be some esoteric tie there. Is there anything that comes to mind with the seven-year cycle and this sort of literally shedding of our skin?
Well, this reference that we found in the SD states it more universally, that universes, planets, and man slough off his skin periodically and then rest and then takes on a new skin. And the serpent symbolizes that. Now, we're sure that analogy can be taken more particularly, as you had stated, that every 7 years our body is rejuvenated, our skin is always sloughing off, and new skin is always being made. So we're constantly growing. We're constantly alive. And it has a lot to do with the liver, that metabolism.
But we also think we kind of misunderstand that. It isn't like at the end of 7 years it happens. It is an ongoing thing, and it really means at a cellular level, this constant replenishment. There's a book in our library here called The Secret House, and it has a most alarming fact in it. It shows a picture of a dust mite, which could not be seen by a human eye, and that if there were not dust mites, a lot of people are allergic to them, but if they didn't exist, in 24 hours you'd be standing knee-deep in dead skin cells because that's what you're sloughing off constantly. So it isn't like, you know, a seven-year period. That just means within that seven-year time frame from start to finish, there has been that replacement.
Even if you take a shower?
Yes.
And the other I guess, analogy that came to mind. The bite of the serpent, regardless of poisonous or not, will immediately put you in a different perspective or frame of mind, whether it's, you know, will I die or what has happened. Similar to when we find these ideas, perhaps for the first time, there is a bite and an awakening and a really fight or flight response to it, because we know certainly we have flown from these ideas when we weren't ready to face them. And then as the time came for that perception to take hold, we shed our skin and we're now in a position.
That's a powerful metaphor you've come up with there. The bite of the snake.
Yeah, it talks about the bite of the snake. Yes.
I published a book about 8 years ago with the title Consecrated Venom, Serpent and the Tree of Knowledge, through the Christian Community Press, which is a branch of the Steiner movement. And I was also fascinated by the image of the serpent and the idea of Moses holding up the serpent in the wilderness. And these are archetypal, powerful images. And but I would also say be careful a little bit, because... And there's no need to bash the Catholic Church, and I'm a Catholic, so I want to defend the Church, that there's a spiritual truth and a but the Christian Church accentuated the moral aspect of the breaking away from God. Instead of being within the obedience of God, within the light, that Eve and Adam kind of broke away from that obedience, so they accentuate the moral truth, whereas spiritual science accentuates the primordial light that our ancestors were in. So.
Well, I would just say, add to that, though, that special attention in the secret doctrine is paid to the fact of Genesis and how we are encouraged to look at what's really being said, at the myths and the backgrounds. And one of the things is that the Elohim, the gods, before they ate of the tree, said, we do not want them to be like us. We don't want them to have our wisdom and our power. Well, if you take the idea literally that they sinned in doing that, it doesn't make any sense that these gods feared that they would be godlike if they did it. So,
in some respects, Genesis is incoherent, but it's also a really powerful story.
Yes, but we think if you take the time to look in the secret doctrine, and of course you'll be hearing some of this on Sunday, and there's a pamphlet by, you know, with some of HBB's articles, Genesis becomes an absolutely fascinating study in mythology, in symbolism. You know how it says there are two creations? In the first creation, the animals were created first. In the second creation, man was created first.
There were two different gods.
Well, no, Blavatsky says the first one is the zodiac.
Right.
Those are the animals that were created first. They put the clock in the sky so that we would have this as a marker. So
the Elohim, right? Or that was the first creation?
The first creation. Yes, they're watching this.
Yeah. And then Jehovah with the creation of the human being.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
Yes, but it's all mystical as well.
Yeah. Well, what's rather ironic about what you just said, because the zodiac is what? Starry matter.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the animal circle.
Yes.
Well, but it's starry matter, and what in us is that starry matter? Our astral.
Yeah.
And that,
which
and,
is the serpent, right?
Which, in one aspect, but in reference to the serpent and the church, the idea of the devil, of evil, as being an entity.
But and this could lead into a long discussion. I mean,
well, it's.
Rudolf Steiner claimed that Lucifer was incarnated in ancient cultures 3,000 years ago. Now, that's controversial. And he says the other guy is due to be incarnated in our time, Satan. It's not a very comforting picture.
Well, but we were under the impression that Lucifer was considered Satan.
Well, this is now there.
Well,
see,
you know, there's Beelzebub and there's
anthroposophy. They are distinguished.
Well,
yeah.
I think perhaps the point though is that these ideas of powers outside of man himself and controlling man is the avenue in which has led mankind to where he is now. That the evil that exists in the universe is in man, is man himself by his selfish acts and his separate ideas. And that is where we think what HPB was placing before us is that this is not an entity per se that is influencing us. It is man himself within his, you know, both sides of spirit and matter. And that serpent that connects them both is mind.
Well,
and that the whole point is choice. That is the power of the mind, but it's also what can lead us to make mistakes because we don't know enough yet. Yes.
So then aren't we also representative of the phoenix arising mm-hmm. from the ashes of our misdeeds and misthoughts and misfeelings to re-recognize, in a sense, that we are that fiery essence? When we have that realization, we're standing as the bridge, perhaps, between spirit and matter, realizing that it's
well, actually, we stand as the bridge at all times. Spirit and matter can only meet in the human mind. They can't meet anywhere else. We can see the right idea, the wrong idea. We can measure our own responses. We can watch ourselves in action. It's the only in the mind that can happen. But the metaphor you just made was lovely, but it's not the common or the normal one. The normal one is, regardless of whether we see the wisdom or the foolishness of our actions, we are consumed in the physical sense of it and then reborn in the same nest. In other words, we don't take on a new line of thought and behavior. We are reborn into our own condition, the way we left it. It isn't linear, but it is our responsibility. So your metaphor is a very nice one and certainly would work if we are learning from our mistakes. But whether we're learning or not, we are the phoenix as well as the snake. Yes.
As the phoenix is to fire, is the serpent to anything elemental?
To fire. Yeah, it's the same thing, isn't
it? It would be the same.
Yeah.
It would be the same. It's the phoenix symbolizes us in our eternal natures, and the snake and the serpent as well. That divine wisdom, which is in potential within all of us. Like we have crucified ourselves on the cross of matter, and we are just wandering in the wilderness, looking for the answer to this great riddle. And the serpent, there was one reference to the fact that the ancients thought that these fiery serpents were direct projections from that absolute, that it was divine wisdom itself, and that these dragons and crocodiles and serpents were all associated with karma. You know, why would we think that would be? Well, if you walked up close to one and you weren't paying attention, you probably would be eaten. Mm-hmm. Or if you were not respectful around a serpent, you would be bitten. You know, that that there's it's not a you know a stretch of the imagination to see that they embody life. The serpent embodies life, and the fact that you know the serpent has been a symbol also for the astrolite. You know, you always see the caduceus of Mercury. It's two snakes, not one, two.
Yes.
And we were thinking also in its relaxed form, I guess we would say, it coils. So it also reminds us, symbol of evolution, that it is a spiral, if you were to stretch it gently, upward.
I would stretch it gently, yes.
I don't know, but I would get near it, that's what I'm
fine. It's interesting that a bird and a snake are both egg-born. And isn't it in modern thinking that the bird is really an evolution from the snakes, from the reptiles?
Scales and feathers.
Right, right. So they really have a great deal in common.
There's a god in Egypt. That he had the body of an alligator or a crocodile and the legs of a man.
Hmm.
And he.
Legs of,
yes.
Legs of a what?
Man.
Man. Well, I thought I wrote it down, but I didn't.
I've seen drawings of
that
crocodile-headed god.
Yeah. Hmm. But he stands for the universe, all of manifestation.
Yeah, like the eagle with a human body, an eagle's head in Buddhism, periodical time.
We keep coming up with strange symbol in our mind. You were talking about this essence being shot out of the absolute as a fiery serpent.
Well, not really the absolute, but probably the first or
first
second.
Exactly. And of course, we're using the physical analogy, but what keeps coming to mind is the lightning bolt. Even with the jag in it, if we consider dragons and things of that nature, there's usually some kind of jagged edge to them. There's just something broken. Yeah.
Well, it's quite a stretch of the imagination to consider a fire-breathing dragon. Well, how would that ever be possible? How would that ever be possible? But there are records, and the ancients speak of these fire-breathing dragons. And, you know, we have in the, was it Mesozoic Age or the Age of the Reptiles, or the pterodactyls and other large birds, and we don't think they were fire breathers, but, you know, they also in the Bible you find the flying camels and references to strange flying creatures. Yeah.
Yes.
So are these symbols then meant to awaken something in us, to stretch our imagination as symbols then? What benefit are these kinds of things?
No, if you read, there's a couple of chapters in The Secret Doctrine on symbolism. And we would think a symbol is sort of created to do exactly what you just said, to make us think, make us remember something, sort of like an educational tool. But the chapters in The Secret Doctrine clearly point out that a symbol always begins on a factual basis, that it has to represent, and then these challenging statements that there are seven keys to every symbol. and you are being given one. And the rest of them you'll have to do for yourself. It's a very exciting challenge. The fact is that they are all meaningful then on seven different levels. And we would think one of the levels has to be based in reality. Ergo, dragons, the phoenix. They must have, at one time, been an actual experience of someone's. And that's why they're recorded. And that's why they have such a lasting impression on each culture. We found that their Native American phoenix was called Yel, Y-E-L. But we could never find anything on it. Just that simple statement of fact. You can find it in every culture. South America, North America, all the continents. But you can't necessarily find a lot of description on it. But a symbol is not just so we will remember, although that's an important part of it. One of the things it says that as you're becoming wiser and more experienced and you are learning about facts of actual events in ancient history that are terrible and tragic, that you are not allowed to ever put them down in writing for fear of reawakening the energies that created them. You must make a symbolic picture for yourself of these teachings. So, yes, they can be very instructive, but they're always based on a reality, not a wish to teach you something. Yes?
Don't forget the feathered serpent. What's our co-op?
The feathered serpent.
The feathered serpent.
Mm-hmm. Must be a serpent on its way to becoming a bird.
It must be.
Mm-hmm.
That's a metaphor that you hear a lot now. Not a lot, but you hear fire breathing for someone who is a really exciting orator. Fire breathing, you know. Malcolm X was often spoken of as a fire breathing, you know, or fire breather. Because
the heat of their passion.
Yeah, very, very exciting orator. So they're using words and as a fire as a metaphor for
mm-hmm.
words.
Yes, we use birds as a metaphor too. Having an eagle eye.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A bird has always been a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Quetzalcoatl, and in the Theosophical Glossary. The serpent god in the Mexican scriptures and legends. His wand and other landmarks show him to be some great initiate of antiquity who received the name of serpent on account of his wisdom, long life, and powers. To this day, the aboriginal tribes of Mexico call themselves by the names of various reptiles, animals, and birds.
So were there phoenix and dragons? And if so, what time period would they be?
Wouldn't know at all. All we know from the studying that we did is that the phoenix has been a symbol in China for at least 7,000 years.
7,000?
Yes.
7,000.
And the serpent has been a symbol since antiquity. It was used as an expression of how the cosmos came into being, how life arose out of the chaos, and it's symbolized as a fiery serpent flashing through the sky.
But did they appear in more than one continent, these two creatures?
Well, initially there was basically one continent. And then there was a separation, so we couldn't answer that except to say, probably.
But we also remember that these are symbols. They stand for something within our own nature that revivify the reality of who we are. And as said, the phoenix is an expression of our mortal nature. We die and are reborn again and again and again out of the ashes of our past life. And the serpent is ever a representation to us of that mystery of earth and of life, that unknowing.
But haven't they been portrayed in more cultures than China, like in the medieval?
Yeah.
You mean the phoenix?
They appear on banners and things?
Oh, you missed it.
Yeah. No, I'm very sorry.
No, that's all right. Just in Egypt, you see it as the heron. It's called Binu, B-E-N-U. And in Japan, in Buddhism, in Turkey, in Persia,
China.
It was everywhere. So, and it's always a bird, a magnificent bird, and it always builds its own nest, sets it on fire, is consumed in the fire, and within a short period is reborn within, and the nest comes back as well. So it is one emblem that is recognizable the world over. Yes.
The use of the fire breathing as one speaking wisdom in the duality that we call life, we might also consider, someone might say, stay away, they're breathing fire today. We also have the potential to burn with our words and our thoughts and feelings too. So it's standing with that much power, how we use it.
How we use the power. You know, it's very interesting, the snake is often remarked upon because it walks without legs. And all of the rivers anywhere in the world follow the pattern of the snake. If you can get up high enough, you see that all rivers are serpentine. And the snake moves in that exact same manner or method. Snakes can't speak. They can hiss, but they can't speak. Or that some snakes can rattle, but they don't speak. And yet it is said that they represent wisdom. Yes?
It has to do with the water we're in.
Yeah. Yes.
The tongue that splits, the one becomes two. And if we finished it, we have the triangle or the triangle.
The forked tongue. It's interesting that the only cure for a snake bite is snake venom. You know, it's, and HPB makes quite a point of that the everything in the universe can either kill or cure. Yes?
That's very interesting. Literature I use, and I've heard it in other sources, the literature I use says the solutions are inherent with problems, and to find the venom in the bite, that's such a glaring example of that idea.
Yes.
That's an interesting idea, that kill or cure, because that points back to vaccinations. Aren't vaccinations the same? You get a taste of whatever it is that...
Actually, Theosophy does not recommend that, because it's not a taste of the same thing. It's taking animal substance into your own blood, and that's what's not recommended. It's a huge study, however. And we can't be glib about it, certainly.
Well, we had the great reptile Typhon. We've heard that name quite often. And the seat of its worship in Egypt was in Crocodilopus.
Crocodilopus? That's fun.
Crocodilopus. And was sacred to Seth, its alleged creator. We can't find where that creature with a body or...
But that's it, isn't it? Typhon? Isn't that
well,
it?
Well, Typhon was a father of this creature. It's not mentioned in this, so I don't think it must be another name that I'll have to bring back.
Perhaps the nicest thing about doing material like this is it makes you go and learn new things and discover things.
Has there been any recent reports of these two creatures in the last century?
Probably not in the last 20 centuries. We've never heard of any such thing.
And, you know, when's the last time we saw a giant? You know, and it's also in the myths and stories of our childhood and
but they also have physical, yes, physical giant remains.
Yes.
Yes.
There's a Loch Ness monster. He's pretty current.
Well, unfortunately, while I believe in the Loch Ness monster because I like to believe in it, unfortunately, the famous photograph taken by a very well-respected Scottish gentleman, upon his death, it was discovered it was a fake. He had faked that famous photograph. But the town of Loch Ness will be eternally grateful because the tourists just flock there. But the loch itself, the lake, Ness, is something like, you know, 500 or 600 feet deep at the center. So it's entirely possible some very large creature did manage to survive and keep reproducing. But you have to wonder what it's eating because nothing's going missing. So, but there are things that we hear about that we delight in because we all like mystery. Yes.
I have one, and it's not that hard to find even. the Pygmies, their origin and their history. You can't really find out a lot about them. Yet they exist. I mean,
yes.
It's not like this is some imaginary people. And on the same continent, you have people who are average height of 7 feet.
Yes.
So you see, there is quite a bit in nature.
A great mixture.
Right.
But of course, as we know, races are dying out. They're offshoots from older races, and we're moving into a transition period. So there'll be more and more of that dying out.
It's noted how, like the elephant and the hippopotamus, they are like the largest creatures on the earth, but they're only in miniatures to what they once were, mm-hmm. And they bring up the fact that, and yet we can even find pygmy elephants and pygmy hippopotami. You know, that nature has such a you know, that we are really shrinking in size, and they will become extinct too, the elephant.
Yes.
Does theosophy teach that races will eventually become one, or cease to be distinguished as they are today?
Well, it explains that we're on the cusp of creating the sixth root race, I mean the sixth sub-race of our present race, the fifth root race, and that will be the precursor of the sixth great race. And all of humanity will eventually be in that greater race. So we are in motion, in transition. But our level of quality of incarnation in the future is, of course, dependent on the choices and uses we put to circumstances and thought. Yes.
Well, but the analogy that's been given for the races is of amalgamation and precipitation, you know, that everything sort of branches out and gets this experience and comes back together and shares it all in the whole mass of humanity. And that's been going on since the very beginning when seven great races appeared simultaneously.
Simultaneously, and then into one so that you could function. But then we go through the various races. It is said that the original Chinese, not the mixture you have now, there's probably very few of them left, are actually remnants of the fourth race of the Atlantean body. And probably the pygmies and such might have been Lemurian. We don't know. Go on. Yes.
Interesting thing. Another Wednesday night that came up because class was on races in the ocean. And it was the next questionnaire that we get from the what we call the people who take the population.
Census?
The census. 18 boxes for races. And they brought this question up among a group of scientists, ethnologists, and all types of scientists, biologists, and it was found that there is no definition, of scientific definition of race. And so that was brought up during the class, and the interesting thing, on page 26 of The Ocean, it gives the definition, but the definition isn't physical.
Right.
That's why there is no definition, because they're dealing strictly with matter. The real truth or the real definition of race is not to be found in the matter, but in the spirit.
Right.
Very, I thought it was interesting.
I think it is interesting. Yes.
I barely know a thing about Asian culture, but I know they annually they release an image of the panda bear on the Chinese coins, on their silver and gold coins and all, and you see their serpent appear in their parades. And I'm just wondering, maybe their images have accuracy if it, you know, what's been seen in real life appears on something or somewhere right. or something else.
Well, as we said earlier, the phoenix has been part of the Chinese culture for over 7,000 years.
As well as the dragon. They have they have the dragon throne. And you find it on banners and of all kinds of tapestries, the dragons. And I guess in probably no other culture do we see such a wide right. variety of dragons as well.
And they have the parade yeah. during Tet. Only this time it was the lion because it's the year of the tiger, huh? Right. So, yes?
We forget who it was who saw whom, but it was Lao Tzu.
Lao Tzu. Confucius went to see Lao Tzu. And when he came back, his students were all over him. You know, what happened? What happened? And he said something like, "Hush, I have just met a dragon." And he wouldn't talk to anybody about it. Yes?
I could have sworn I've seen images of the serpent and similar creatures on British flags and banners.
On state flags, you see the serpent on... Don't tread on me is what Vermont.
Yeah,
you know, but the ancient Indian culture that lived here before we did, they revered the serpent, and I know many desert tribes as part of the initiation or that vision quest was becoming one with that serpent, and oftentimes it meant the serpent bit you for you to become one with it, and sometimes they would die. But it was a part of a rite of passage.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's still cults here in America yeah. where they wrestle with snakes as a religious thing.
And actually, it's supposed to be based on the fact that Jesus picked up the snake in the wilderness, mm-hmm. something to that effect. Now, that's some symbolism. I wonder what the symbolism on that was, that Jesus lifted the snake up in the wilderness.
That was Moses.
Well, Moses. No, but Moses did it in front of the Pharaoh, and his snake turned in.
Oh, yeah.
No, his staff turned into a snake.
Yeah.
After the magicians threw theirs down and they turned into snakes, his turned into a snake and ate it. But no, it's supposed to be Jesus, I'm pretty sure. Because
in the wilderness.
A fundamental group.
Not Jesus. Moses was in the wilderness.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but Moses did the thing with the snake in front of the Pharaoh with another...
The Gospel of John, and Moses held up the serpent in the wilderness. John,
oh, okay, so we'll have to review that.
Yeah.
We wanted to end with this quote from Thomas Carlyle and remind you that the phoenix represents immortality, the snake represents wisdom. And to be wise, we have to know our own immortality. Though all dies and even gods die. Yet all death is but a phoenix fire death and new birth into the greater and the better. Meeting is adjourned.
See the light, I was saying, oh, you didn't cut it on.
Yeah, I did, but...